The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Attention, ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, you are about to embark on a journey of self-discovery, of knowledge and wisdom, of science and reason. You, my friends, are now listening to Skeptically Speaking, the show where we ask you to call in and question everything. That's right, folks, we are phone-equipped again. Well, we hope so. Skeptically Speaking starts right now with your hostess, Dez.
Thanks, Sean. Yes, audience, we have phones again. We tested them twice, hopefully everything is a go. Today on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about censorship with Dennis Young, leader of the Libertarian Party of Canada. Also in the studio will be special guest Matthew Johnson, owner of the web magazine The Western Standard. This is going to be an interesting show, people. Stay tuned. First on our list, though, is speaking up with local skeptic and semi-regular to the show, Mike Harrison.
Hello.
And he'll be speaking about the epigenome.
That's correct.
What's that?
Okay, so I have a little introduction kind of bit for this, but when I think about what makes me human and, say, like, not an ostrich or something like that, I typically think about genes. Genes, you know, let's take a basic definition. They're the blueprints of life. They control everything from hair color to blood sugar, telling cells which proteins to make, how much, when, and where, that kind of thing. But that doesn't really answer the question of what differentiates, say, like, I've had some friends that are identical twins, right? So they have exactly the same genes. What exactly makes them different from each other? It turns out the answer to that is the epigenome. It's a rapidly emerging field in genetics, and actually it's we've known about it for a long time, but we didn't realize until recently how important it is. To understand how it works, we kind of have to break down how genes are held in the cell just a little bit. So genes are contained in DNA, and DNA is contained in chromosomes. Chromosomes are long tube-like structures made of chromatin, which is a combination of DNA, RNA, and protein. Now, the protein kind of forms this core in the DNA that kind of holds it together, gives it structure, and, as it turns out, also regulates expression. And most of the protein is a material called histones. And histones kind of act as spools. The DNA wraps around them. And, you know, without the histones, like, DNA is so long, it would be, like, several miles in length or something. There was a statistic I read on that. But basically, we've found that the histones can be in one of two positions now. Like I said, we just thought they were structural for a while. For a while, we thought that they only controlled the expression of genes during things like right after the zygote is fertilized, so, you know, in developing babies and such, and at puberty. But as it turns out, these are probably active all the time, or these are active all the time. So you have these histones, which are sort of matched up to all the base pairs, right? So you have sets of genes that control all these different traits, and to each trait, there's a matching histone group. Now, the histones can be affected in one of two ways. They can have a chemical group attached to it that's basically an acetyl acid or a methyl acid. And these two, depending on which of these is attached, basically it'll cause the structure of the histone to constrict, kind of wrapping the DNA a little bit tighter at that particular point. And depending on whether the DNA is wrapped tightly or open, that particular gene is accessible, which means it's more likely to be expressed. So this is the method by which transcription and what genes are to be transcribed is controlled. And it's really interesting. More We knew that there had to be something like this, but what's really interesting and what we're learning now is that we can make modifications to the histones over the course of our lives, which is a huge change from modern genetic theory, which pretty much says that everything is based upon what genes are passed on at death, and that you don't see evolution during the course of lifespan, you know, of an organism's lifespan. But it turns out we do, actually. And we can measure these effects, and we can do all kinds of interesting things.
So you said, so how do we affect these genes then? How do we change these?
Well, there's a number of different things. The factors that affect this expression, sorry, there's a couple different ones here, but basically it's toxins. It can be things like exercise. There's a great deal of supporting evidence that says it has something to do with, like, general diet. and sort of activity, but also things like social interaction can even influence it, which is really, really interesting. They take in one of the studies I was looking at, they were taking rats, basically. And depending on whether or not the rat had, whether the young rat had been around its infant and had been around its mother, and the mother had done, you know, the requisite snuggling thing.
Sound disdainful.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
Certain genes in the rat would be turned on or off, including ones that regulated mood. So the ones that and they were able to see this genetically, right? That certain proteins were being expressed more often than others. This led to an observable calming effect on the rats that had the motherly influence, and the reverse effect in the other group. What's more, they were even able to take these rats later on and put them in that sort of environment, and they were able to reverse this effect. So these changes in the epigenome, determining which genes are being expressed and how often can be modified, it's fascinating. It's really going to change how we're going to have to approach genetics, because, I mean, one of the assumptions of, you know, for example, the Human Genome Project was that all the information contained, all the information relevant to diseases and to how, you know, the body works and everything was contained within the genome. But once we realized that there's this higher level body that's regulating what comes from the genome and how often, it becomes much more complicated than that. We can't just look at the genome to see everything that the body can do. A large part of it has to do with what's in those histones.
Awesome. Things I don't know at all. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. All right, now it's time for Brownie in Motion. For those of you that don't know, Brownian motion is the seemingly random movement of particles, which very much usually describes this segment.
I don't move anywhere. I just sit right here in this chair. So I don't know what you're talking about.
Hello, Brownie.
That's why. Yeah, how's it going? Okay, today I wanted to talk about a meme that's rocking the tubes, particularly in the skeptics community. And that is an effect that's been discovered, a psychological effect called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And the reason it's relevant in the community is that if anybody's argued with certain individuals, like, say, on the utility or on the existence of evolution, the process and the evidence, mm-hmm. you'll find on occasion you'll run into individuals who seem to know absolutely sweet nothing about what they're talking about, and yet are absolutely convinced that they're experts and won't hear any evidence to the contrary. Well, apparently this is explained by something called the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is based on a study done by a couple of researchers named Justin Kruger and David Dunning, so appropriately enough. And the study showed up in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology in 1999. Why it's taken so long to be sweeping the nation, I don't know. But it's called Unskilled and Unaware of It, How Difficulties in Recognizing One's Own Incompetence Leads to Inflated Self-Assessments. So what they did was they took a bunch of, they did four separate experiments, and what they did was they took university-age volunteers, assessed them in their ability to, in three key ways. One was their understanding and appreciation of humor.
Mm-hmm.
One was, and the other was their understanding of English grammar and their capabilities in it, and the other was their understanding of logic. And what they found was that the students, of course, were distributed on some sort of curve after they performed these tests. They were skilled at some sort of level. What they found was that those who were at the lowest level of competency in those skills tended to evaluate their own behavior as much, much better. So those that were in the lowest percentile almost invariably rated themselves around the 67th, 70th percentile.
Really?
Of ability. That's right. And then, another part of the study was then they had these same individuals then evaluate each other's exams and not given them the answer key, but to go ahead and mark those. And the same thing was borne out. Those individuals who knew the least about any particular subject also tended to evaluate other people's knowledge as particularly poor. Now, the other thing is, what was interesting was that the individuals who scored the highest tended to devalue their own performance, especially in relationship to other individuals. So those that pretty well aced the exams, when asked how they thought they did, they tended to give similar results. Oh, okay, I think I'm around 67, 70%,
really?
Maybe 80. And that sort of thing. Yeah, it's
that
really, really
so
fascinating.
That says so much about our society right there.
Well, Michael and I were talking about it a little earlier, and I mean, I think there are some without getting into a little, there's always a difficulty with looking at anything from an evolutionary psychological perspective, and one is that it's really, really hard to do tests on that. But, I mean, it seems like there are some pretty good reasons for why people might have inflated self assessments. In fact, Mike had mentioned a study that I'd also heard of where they'd looked at individuals with depression versus those with non-depression, and individuals who were suffering from depression tended to have more accurate self-assessments of their own competency. So it seems that there might be something to be said for just our own human ability to, you know, plump ourselves up.
To compensate. So
it seems like optimism is a fairly healthy thing from an evolutionary perspective. Now, what is interesting, and then they went on with this study, and they did find that individuals could be trained out of this, that it wasn't some function of some people aren't just inherently stupid. And keep in mind that this is not some claim about these individuals' competency in general. It just happened to be what they knew about a particular subject or how skilled they were in it. So it wasn't that somebody, you know, that the students who were lousy at grammar were lousy at everything and tended to walk around with these inflated egos. Mm-hmm. Just so happened that they were poor at grammar and mistook themselves for actually being skilled at it. They went even further then. And they found that once they trained these individuals, given them a few remedial classes and brought their competency up, their ability to self-assess and to assess other people tended to be aligned better with reality. So it's something to be. So it seems that. So their suggestion, thesis, is that assessing competency within oneself and others requires this sort of metacognitive effect. Where you need to be aware of exactly how much information is out there, and in order to assess how much or little you know of it. And I mean, this is borne out in all kinds of sayings. You know, absolutely. The more you know, the more you realize how little you know. And I mean, I think we would all be subject to this on various particular fields, especially ones that we don't know. So I think it serves a little bit as a warning too. Sometimes when you don't know what the hell you're talking about, you need to just shut up and let the experts weigh in, or at least be quiet for a while until you've gained that. I also wanted to, since we do have members of the Libertarian Party and people from the Western Standard around, I wanted to mention two books that might be interesting, because one of the things that's well known is that people tend to make poor decisions about stuff. We're bad at risk assessment. We're bad at understanding what's good for us in the long term versus short term. Mm-hmm. Some people are better and worse at it. But there are two particular books I wanted to bring up. Both which evaluate the same kind of information, but come up with different conclusions. So one is, by the way, I've not actually read either of these books. So
they just sounded cool.
Nice.
Yeah. So
if they're bad, nobody can really blame you in the end.
No, what I'm saying is that feel free to apply Dunning-Kruger to me in this particular instance.
Very
so I'm
nice.
Encouraging you all out to go out and get these two books, or at least take a look at them. One is by a professor named Peter Ubel, a professor of medicine and psychology at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, and his book is called Free Market Madness, which investigates the irrational tics that lead people to overbid on eBay, eat too much, and I'm actually reading out of Scientific American Mind, which is a wonderful magazine. Pick it up. It's bi-monthly. It's awesome. And take out mortgages that they can't afford. And he goes on and says that this leads to all sorts of economic problems. On the other side of the coin is a book by well-known skeptic and author Michael Shermer, who has a book called The Mind of the Market, How Biology and Psychology Shape Our Economic Lives. Whereas, in fact, he goes and says, look, we do exactly the opposite. We also make irrational decisions. We're somewhat poor at doing this, but on the overall, our behavior can, en masse, lead to fairly good decisions. Things take care of themselves. So, anyways, check those both out. I'll have the links to them, and as well as the paper for Dunning-Kruger. And, So I'm going to get out of here, because I'm really, really excited to hear what these two gentlemen have to say.
Absolutely.
And I'll be listening in the other room.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
All right. We're going to go to ad time here, and we'll be back with the main interview in a few moments.
Do you ever wonder how decisions are made at CJSR? Is it like this?
We're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week. But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting by a civil majority in the case of purely internal affairs, but by a two-thirds majority in the case...
Or is it like this?
The Lady of the Lake, her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite, held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
You won't know unless you attend CJSR's annual general meeting. If you're a member of CJSR, you have the opportunity to take part in our simple majority voting system and vote in new board members, or become a board member yourself. Or perhaps you just want to meet some of our interesting volunteers. So be sure to come out to CJSR's annual general meeting and take part in how decisions are made here at the station. That's June 4th at 6 p.m. Check CJSR.com for more details. And be sure to come out and vote.
Come and see the violence inherent in the system!
Here at Skeptically Speaking, we encourage you to call in and question everything. During tonight's episode, you can call us at 780-492-CJSR extension 1 to join in the conversation. Again, that number is 780-492-2577 extension 1. Or feel free to comment on tonight's episode at skepticallyspeaking.com. We'd also love to see you join our Skeptically Speaking Facebook group, or have you follow Skeptical Radio on Twitter. Of course, if you want to reach us the old school way, you can email us at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com.
And we are back, everybody.
So, again, we do have phones, so it's 492-2577 extension 1, that's area code 780, and as usual, live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you tweet, it's at Skeptical Radio.
And we don't have a lot of faith in these phones, so we'll give them one shot,
yeah.
But we have a brand new system here, so we're hoping for the best. We've done a little testing, seems good.
Perfect. So we are back with two gentlemen. First, we have Dennis Young. Dennis did two separate tours of Germany and Bosnia, and he was a military police officer who was on the task force assigned to the Iperwash occupation in Ontario. He worked in oil patch operations, and now, in addition to being the leader of the Libertarian Party of Canada, he owns Traffic Corps Calgary? Am I getting that right? Perfect.
Yep, that's right.
Otherwise known as FightThatTicket.com. Also in the studio with us is Matthew Johnson, owner of the Western Standard. Now, you may remember the Western Standard from a very public battle they had a while back about republishing a Danish cartoon that pictured an image of Mohammed. And for those of you that don't know, in Islam, that is known as a very bad thing. But we'll get to that a little later. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, audience, if you'd like to ask the gentleman some questions, get in line. So, just to start out by defining our terms here, what is censorship? I realize that's a big question, and I had to do a lot of thinking about what exactly I consider it.
I'd take a shot at that. I mean, I think from a libertarian perspective, and Dennis Young is a leader of the Libertarian Party, but the Western Standard, since we discontinued our print publication, has a libertarian editorial flavor, so we give this a fair amount of thought. For us, censorship is specifically a government prohibition on speech, and I think it's that's a distinction that's important, at least for the Western Standard, because every publication and certainly every radio show and would set limits to the kind of speech they want, the kind of expressions that they want. So, and I think that's not censorship. At least it's not the sort of censorship that that we're concerned with, as far as the Western Standard editorial perspective, and perhaps your readers would share a similar concern in terms of government encroaching on our ability to express ourselves.
So specifically government.
I would define it that way, and I'm sure people would take issue with that, but in terms of defining the terms, that's where
perfect.
I would come from.
Okay. What do you think?
Yeah, that's perfect. We're after the Libertarian Party in general is against the coercion and force of government. You know, I'm welcome to do anything in my private life. I can censor my kids. That's not censorship to us. It strictly speaks to government.
Okay, interesting. Because I think I came up with sort of a broader picture of what censorship is, and the longer I thought about it, the more things I wanted to include in it. But for me, the word censorship really covers, like you said, what the government excludes, restricts, or removes access to, in terms of things we say, we do, we read, that kind of thing. But it also includes importations by Canada Customs. obscenity charges laid against visual and performing artists, the banning of films by censor boards, hate crime legislation, libel and slander laws, publication bans. For me, that all falls in under the mantle of censorship. But also, it covers public or media challenges. So, you know, for example, situations where parents want different books pulled from public libraries. It also covers self-censorship when we purposely don't speak about things that are controversial because they are controversial. And also whitewashing, just in terms of something as simple as using euphemisms like friendly fire. That's to me, that's it's a form of censorship. So that's the perspective that I'm taking. So I'm very, very broad.
I think the broad definition is probably the best one. I would suggest that we've had this discussion at length at the Western Standards question of censorship happens in our daily lives. We censor ourselves, but what censorship should we be concerned with? Mm-hmm. And when people act to exclude certain ideas from a publication or from a radio show, it's sort of part of what free expression is about. Perversely, free expression isn't about saying everybody has to be all things to all audiences. It, mm-hmm. it really is about saying free expression is about people being able to do what they want and in terms of how they express themselves or say what they want.
Being able to do and say what they want, and that's the thing. I guess another way to think about our rights and about censorship is we are allowed to say whatever we want and do whatever we want until it encroaches on someone else. Would you agree with that?
Not necessarily. Okay. We can say things that do. I would say that the cartoons encroached on someone else. People have a right to encroach on someone else. It's the government precluding us from encroaching on someone else.
Interesting.
Generally speaking, the libertarian views is your rights end at the tip of somebody's nose, and that you can express yourself freely as long as you don't harm someone else. So when you use the word encroach, I suppose libertarians generally speaking would say, yeah, that's right. But it does get to be a bit of a tricky subject when ideas in the public arena. It would be dishonest to say that for example, the Western Standard decision to publish Dana's cartoons or republish didn't have some negative effect on somebody out there. I mean, no doubt people were, and I wouldn't just call it hurt feelings. I mean, it's easy to say some people had hurt feelings, but more than that, some people profoundly upset by what we did, felt alienated. So when you publish or do anything like that, you're bound to have make an impact on people, and not always a positive one. I think in order for us to live in a free society, we have to maybe clearly define what it means to harm somebody. And I think that, for me, is at the essence of it. And I think a lot of free speechers can be a little glib about saying, oh, all these people with hurt feelings, they should just get over it. I don't accept that. I think actually there's very real consequences to the decisions we make as publishers or radio personalities or political leaders when they make public statements. There are real consequences, but how do we balance all of these diverse views and interests is the tricky part.
Well, I have to agree with that one. Before the show, actually last night we were talking about this, and we talked about the issue of intruding into somebody's space, and I remember giving the example. Obviously, I think we would all agree that we really don't have the right to walk up to a stranger and punch them in the face. But often, words can almost have a longer lasting hurtful effect when they hit the right note with somebody. And
that's the thing; it has emotional repercussions are sometimes far more long-lasting and far more deeply felt than physical repercussions, obviously.
It's absolutely right. I mean, I think again, it would be intellectually dishonest to suggest that that what people do in the realm of ideas has no consequence,
right,
or that it doesn't impact people negatively. I really do think we have to step back and think about the questions of the initiation of force. What qualifies as an act of aggression against somebody? What qualifies as harm? Because in the absence of a clear definition, we really are all walking on eggshells. One word away from a human rights investigation.
Exactly, and that itself has many ramifications. So we also we do have a caller on the line, and I think just before we put that person on, I think maybe probably what we can do rather than talking about more about key terms and more about the legal aspects of this is to talk about some specific instances of, you know, defamation suits, hate crime issues, and censorship, and talking about what they mean for us as a society. But first of all, we'll go to a caller.
Hi, Paul. Do we have you there?
Yeah, this is Paul from the Society of Impotent Atheists.
How's it going tonight?
I'm doing well. My question relates to censorship and the separation of church and state, and kind of ties into what Matthew was saying about the Muhammad cartoons. I'm wondering, isn't the root of a lot of censorship just the result of religious organizations imposing their will through government? I mean, the UN had that big debate about limiting speech that criticizes religion, specifically Islam. Was the Organization of Islamic States that brought that about?
And we're going to talk about that a little bit. So, do keep going.
But I'm also wondering, isn't this just the other side of the same coin that saw puritanical Christians passing laws preventing me from saying fuck on the RADIO?
Wow. Sneak the second.
You know.
Such bad language.
Libertarians.
But I think it's an excellent point, Paul. I mean, people want to see their preferences protected by the state. Whatever those preferences are, we want the state to protect them. And I think we have to get out of the habit of saying, I value all of these things, and so the government should step in and protect the things that I value. Because the government doesn't always have a role to play in doing that. You know, I may be an atheist, I know you are, Paul, or I may be a Muslim or Christian, but that's the point is that we can't expect the government to protect the things that we value from criticism, or even give it a privileged status in society. I mean, we can't expect that Christianity shouldn't be the dominant culture necessarily. I mean, or Islam, or even a secular culture shouldn't necessarily dominate with government protection.
Yeah, exactly. Because the way I see right now is, I mean, we always have the option to change the channel.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's the application of force. So everyone says, well, this is the way life should be, and we want to apply force so that that's the way life is. And I always say, when you get the gays and the gun owners and the Islamics standing together saying, government, get out of my life, then we'll have freedom.
Yeah, then you got something.
Yeah.
All right,
thank you.
Oh, great. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you very much.
Bye now.
So,
I think on if I could maybe a quick don't let me talk too long, Desiree.
No.
But when the Western Standard published the Danish cartoons, I was a senior vice president of the company at the time, and we were very critical of radical Islam in the print edition. But I felt that we weren't as balanced as we could be. I didn't have a direct role to play in the editorial product, but we would sort of celebrate the radicalization of the Christian faith and lament the radicalization of the Muslim faith. And I thought, you know, we're really, you know, we're just picking a team here, you know, and is it an authentic liberal opposition to, you know, the imposition of values? Is it a genuine, authentic view of separation of church and state? And so as much as I was proud when we made the decision to publish the cartoons, I felt that, the magazine would have more moral authority if we had perhaps taken a slightly more balanced approach to how we treat religious issues. And again, the radicalization of the Christian faith, the evangelical faith, is something that's often celebrated by conservatives, a kind of return to good old-fashioned religious values. But, you know, if it's a threat in one faith, perhaps it's a threat in another faith.
But that, to me, is quite typical of what we think of a lot of issues, that, you know, we want our own free speech rights protected, but we do want to stifle other people's when they say things that we don't like.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, we're all like that. And I believe we have a call.
Yes, we do. Nathan, are you on... Nathan, are you there?
I'm here.
All right.
So, I actually, Des, your comment there is kind of segued into what I was wanting to say. What do you see that the government's role would be in order to protect free speech when it's unpopular? Like, say, for example, you say Zinu's a cult leader of...
You might have to explain Zinu.
Famous.
I don't know if everybody understands Scientology.
Well, essentially, there's been a lot of court cases when someone mentions Scientology or in a bad light, talks about some of their wacky beliefs, they'll come out and sue them and destroy the people. Is there not possibly a role that government could do to protect these people?
I would apply it to a civil law in that case. So if they're getting, they would have to, Scientologists would have to demonstrate direct harm. And if they can prove that, if Tom Cruise or whichever Scientologist can prove that he was directly harmed, and I like the example of the restaurant, where I'm not sure this applies to Scientology at all, and I don't think that Scientologists would be successful if we looked at it this way. But if I said, if you owned a restaurant and I said, well, that restaurant served rat meat last week and his sales went from 5,000 a day down to 500 a day, then you've done real harm by speaking, and you could show that harm in a civil case, then you would win. I'm not sure that the Scientologists could prove that.
I would take it a step further than that, and the issue that we're discussing here is really defamation law, and I take perhaps a fairly radical view that defamation law is a tool that violates free speech. Now, I don't like being defamed, and certainly I wouldn't argue for a minute that defamatory comments don't do real harm, but I can't help but think that that the question of reputation as doesn't qualify as real property, and that defamation law is really a tool that can be used against free speech. We've seen it all the time with slap suits and whatnot, and the legal process, pardon me, is expensive, and defamation, as a publisher, I fear a defamation lawsuit much more than I fear a Canadian human rights complaint, because I can walk through the human rights process, speak one-on-one with a bureaucrat, make my case. I'm not suggesting I'm going to win, but the sanctions are small. It's a process that's, because it's quasi-judicial, there's not a lot of legal process that I can get caught up in. But defamation law concerns me. I've been threatened several times as a publisher with defamation.
Oh, my God.
And it's not fun. It's a very terrifying thing, because you think, this is a $50,000 process to go through. And as an independent publisher, that's a very significant cost.
Now, I actually would like to talk a little bit more about defamation, but I know we have another caller.
It is a busy phone line night here, and I do apologize to our callers. I'm going to have to cut you off fairly soon after asking your questions. We just have the one line tonight, and that just keeps things going smoothly here. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, Chris Wisely speaking. How is everybody doing?
Doing
well,
good.
Thanks for calling.
Hello, Desiree. Hello, Sean, and hello, listeners. Just to everyone listening to the show, calling in is the only way you'll get a hold of Desiree. This woman does not answer her phone.
Thank you, Chris.
I have a question for the Libertarian Party leader as a volunteer at Alberta Hospital Edmonton. I work with criminal offenders who have been found not criminally responsible by reason of mental disorder. And one of the things we're trained is to treat the staff, of course, very kindly and very gently. Of course, freedom of speech is quite restricted in a mental hospital because the emotional and verbal treatment of the patients is quite important for their therapies. And I'm wondering how the Libertarian Party would approach that, especially in view of their favor, in that they favor privatization of all healthcare services. Because on the one hand, you do have to be friendly to the patients who are mentally ill. You have to coax them back into a state of mental health. But on the other hand, you cannot be so sugar-coated to them that when they get into the real world, they'll be so shocked that they have to come back into the hospital. Can you reflect a bit on that?
That's a medical. I imagine that that's a medical decision made by doctors. Certain people are. We're dealing with an institutionalized people, and I don't think you should expect a free society in a mental institution. So, just like prisoners of any sort can't expect freedom. I'm talking about the society at large. So it wouldn't freedom libertarianism wouldn't apply to a mental institution.
Great, thank you. Yeah, well, like I said, we're just gonna cut off everyone. We did it to Nathan too. Just as soon as the next phone line rings, we're in trouble. So
yeah, I think I found the caller's question interesting, because I think there's a lot of fascinating libertarian elements to mental health questions. I write about a fair amount on the Western Standard site. I think this current Alberta government is so badly off track on the treatment of the mentally ill that in terms of their their treatment. And, you know, this the question was very specific to, as Dennis points out, the question of treatment and how much free speech do you allow someone in a in that sort of clinical setting. That's, as Dennis points out, I think better left to doctors. But in terms of the overall treatment of the mentally ill, I think the Alberta government, to me, has done some very dangerous things in the last couple of years, in particular the amendment to the Mental Health Act removing the dangerousness criteria, which is, I know that the Gateway wrote about it here at the U of A campus, and I think covered the issue very well. And it's a frightening situation. I probably deviating slightly from a free speech debate, but it's been bugging me for a long time, so I thought I would share it.
It's good to get it out.
The Soviets had a similar program where if you said something against the state, you were mentally ill.
That's right.
Well, there's our segue right there.
Well, there you go.
Let's go back a bit to defamation. Because there's actually a recent, quite recent, like last week, case. Simon Singh, he's, you know, people in the skeptical community will probably know who he is. He wrote an article that was published, and it was about chiropractic and how there was, you know, no evidence that it works. This was... And it wasn't that was the issue. It was the fact that he had said that the Chiropractors Association, I believe I have the quote here, happily promotes bogus treatments. So the Chiropractors Association sued for libel. And on May 7th, a high court judge ruled that the natural and ordinary meaning of the phrase, which is the relevant legal test, was that the BCA was being consciously dishonest and knowingly promoting quack treatments. But Simon Singh had previously said, I think alternative therapists who offer treatments unsupported by reasonable evidence are deluded rather than deliberately dishonest. So the key legal term there is he had said that they happily promoted, which is slander in this case. But this has nothing to do with the effectiveness of or the evidence based of chiropractic medicine.
I think that's an excellent example of precisely why defamation law puts a chill on free speech. That was a very innocuous comment shared by
Absolutely.
Many people. I personally think it's probably, and I don't want to be defamed, and
yes,
I don't want to drag your station yes. into a defamation suit. But I mean, a lot of people feel strongly about alternative medicine and. Plenty of traditional doctors think it's quackery, and that seems like an awful case, and an unfair person's been unfair. I assume he was forced to pay damages,
absolutely,
or an apology, and
You know, like I said earlier, what were the damages specifically? If you can't point that out, there should be no damages awarded.
Right.
But having said that, I've been a patient of chiropractic medicine, and it did wonders
Don't
for
sue
me.
Us.
No, it did do wonders for me, and I'm not just saying that.
Spare us your medical
really
quackery.
No, we can talk about the placebo effect until the cows come home. But that's the situation is that I think one of. Regardless of this case and the, you know, poor Simon Singh, that's crap. But my problem is that since this didn't directly relate to any evidence about it, it was just slander, a lot of people will be maybe dissuaded from writing about this kind of thing, from doing research on this. They will be afraid to speak out about it because of these kind of issues.
Absolutely. I mean, I stay, as a publisher, I stay away from writing about people who sue. For definitely. I really do. I mean, I'll be the first to admit it.
That's an editorial decision.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't want to write about, you know, people may know David Warman, who is who's very active with on the human rights file, is in some lawsuit with Ezra Levant. I don't know where it stands. But I put a chill on our writers and say, be careful what you say about David Warman. We don't worry about other people because we assume other people are not going to be as litigious and who aren't going to, in my mind, abuse the legal process to stifle free speech, which is exactly what some of these defamation complainants are doing.
Okay, let me see. I have honestly.
A bajillion questions. well, we could always go to our next week's show promo if you like. Or
No. I'm just wondering which one I should do because I have literally, this was so interesting to research everybody. Anybody who was watching me tweet this morning, I was very angry at 5:30 in the morning reading more about this stuff. Note to self, do not read things that will make you angry before 10 o'clock.
Well, speaking of Twitter there, I did want to give a little shout out to Sarah, who started following us during the show live here. If you want to get a little shout out yourself, follow Skeptical Radio on Twitter.
Nice call, Sean. Self-promotion. So actually, one of the things that also is quite recent is there was recently a verdict against a teacher who spoke out against creationism. Has anybody heard about this? Interesting situation. In the classroom, he described creationism as superstitious nonsense. And it was ruled to have violated, this is in the States, to have violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. He was a 20-year teacher, and he was accused by a student of repeatedly promoting hostility towards Christians in class and advocating irreligion over religion in violation of the First Amendment. So, and what I was talking about before, we always, you know, I hear about a teacher trying to set students straight, and I get very excited. But on the other hand, if we're going to have a separation of church and state, it should be a separation of church and state, and that's on both sides.
On that issue, I'd like to see a separation of school and state, and we can avoid this conflict altogether. But these cases, they're troubling, and there's so many examples of cases like this. Whether it's the human rights laws, or whether even the hate crimes laws, which I know are more popular because they deal with speech that is truly repugnant and probably criminal. Although I'm not entirely clear on that, but there's just so many new ways to constrain what people say, and unless there's some public discussion about, you know, setting some real clear standards of harm, and Dennis has spoken specifically about economic harm, much easier to prove. But in other instances, it's really important that we set a very high threshold so that we can say what we want, and we don't have to feel afraid. And whether you're a publisher or anybody else, I get calls all the time from just some guy who has a blog or writes comments, and usually these people are awful people, if I can be frank. Mm-hmm. I mean, they usually do harbor racist ideas and sexist ideas and homophobic ideas, and they're the worst people. But we protect the worst people because we know that by protecting them, our free speech is protected as well. And so, that's why we take the unpleasant task of defending these creeps, and with the hopes that all of our freedoms are protected.
We focus too much on stifling one side of the argument when we should focus on, getting the other side out and getting their message out so that we can have real debate between, we spoke about the chiropractic earlier, instead of saying, they're a bunch of quacks, okay, prove your case, prove that you're not quacks, and let's have a free and open discussion about this.
Agreed. Well, if we stay on this topic, as well as hate speech, how about white power rallies? Now, this is something that I am very torn on, because I advocate as little censorship as possible in every element of society. But on the other hand, you got a bunch of people walking down the street wearing swastikas and, Ku Klux Klan outfits, and is the best way to deal with that saying no, that they shouldn't be allowed? Because I think maybe that's not the best way, because then it adds an element of mystique. First of all, they can play the martyrs that they weren't allowed to go out and protest and do their thing. And I think maybe a better way of dealing with stuff like that is counter-protesting, definitely.
Well, sure. I mean, that was the problem in Germany, that we could say that certain people were like rats and show, images of them scurrying around the floor, but the accused people couldn't respond. So it's a lack of free speech. But I'm from Calgary, so just about a month ago, they had a Nazis walking down the street.
That's the one I was thinking
and
about.
You show me, around 1 million Calgarians, every single person in that city, less the marchers, thought they were a pack of morons.
Yeah.
So I think it's good that they were allowed to march. Show these idiots for what they are. And I don't see the advantage to stifling them, putting them underground, and having them say what they say, and having no alternative speech.
I agree.
In so many elements of life, we let people prove how much of idiots they are to begin with. This is just one more one of those ways.
Yeah. I'm glad they're allowed to march. And
that's right. You know, we Dennis and I actually had a chance to go to the Anarchist Book Fair in Calgary and talk talk to some of the people who fought these racists. And I'm not really familiar with with this group of people. I the left anarchists are a curious bunch to me. I think they should wear more bright colors. But other than that, they're actually
it's been said.
They have I find them to be intellectually honest and dedicated and bona fide radicals, which I love so much. And so, but anyways, they were talking to us and about their, they mounted the counter protest. And it got violent. And I said, like, why wouldn't you just let these idiots just, do their thing, whatever it is that they do, and no one is listening. And his answer, I won't mention his name because I've forgotten it, but I wouldn't anyways, but his answer was that these guys are kind of like they're not so much a political movement as they are a gang, and that they beat up minorities, and that, so we step, we show up at these events, and we show them that, hey, here's a gang here to show you that you can't flex your muscle freely in our city. And I was sort of compelled by that. I thought, my initial thought was, let these guys march and leave them alone, and this is what free speech is about. But then part of me thought, if this is sort of a criminal element bent on using coercion against innocent people, and you've got these self-appointed guardians of minority groups
Absolutely.
Coming out to, to kick some butt, I'll turn a blind eye to that, and maybe it's a contradiction of my core beliefs. I don't know, but I couldn't help but think, cool guy.
I think that means you're human.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
That's what happened in Germany. The gang became the state. Now, if that gang was kept, if the state had been kept powerless, then these thugs would, although controlling the state, would be pretty much powerless. So you have to keep, a lot of oil companies right now view Stelmach as a gangster. He's saying, we want economic freedom. We want to take our chances and drill and make money from it. And Stelmach's saying, oh, no, you won't. I'm a gangster. Get out of my country. Or get out of my jurisdiction.
I think
Libertarian Party leader lost our left of center audience. we had the permit.
Hundreds of people listening to the station were like, who? The Libertarians don't sound so bad. Again, sorry, callers. I keep forgetting to announce it. It's 492-2577, extension 1. That's area code 780-492-2577, extension 1. Or live at skepticallyspeaking.com or at Skeptical Radio.
Right.
I almost forgot that one.
We are going to quickly play the promo for next week's show before we run out of time to do so later on. Hopefully we will have a caller when we get back. Hint, hint, audience out there. But we'll continue this discussion in about 40 seconds.
Okay. On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about quitting smoking. Well, we're not just talking about it, we're doing it. We'll be discussing some science-based and some decidedly non-science-based stopping smoking methods, and then we're putting them into practice. If you want information on ways to quit, or you want to encourage us, or you want to quit with us, or you just want to laugh at our suffering, tune in to the next Skeptically Speaking every Friday at 6 p.m. here on CJSR.
Short and sweet.
We have 9 more minutes, so if you want to get in, do it now. So I still want to talk about hate crimes. And I think, recently, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, the Mormon church, one of the Mormon churches here in Edmonton, there was a fire deliberately set. And so they called in the hate crimes squad, group, department, whichever it's called. But a different situation, a couple of months ago, the atheist group on campus had their banner, the email address was torn off of it, and it was quite a large banner. The email address was torn off it, and someone wrote Jesus Loves You on the banner. And there was barely an investigation done at all. I believe the president of the UAAA had mentioned something about this, could this be classified as a hate crime? And people were up in arms about that, about using that kind of language. So why, if the letter of the law explains that hate crimes are crimes against a group for the fact that people are in that group and it's a minority group, wouldn't atheists fall into that category? Would hate crimes?
I personally, I'm against the hate crimes, major crimes in general. As a former policeman, they require that the state proves means, motive, and opportunity. Now, motive is a small part. You have to prove motive, but you don't sentence on motive. It's silly. If I strike you, then I should be charged for assault. You're almost saying, well, with a hate crime, we're going to say a striking person because he's brown. It doesn't matter if he's brown.
It's striking plus. So,
yes, and I don't see, if I strike a white person or a brown person, they're going to try the motive. It seems silly to me. Like, let's just try the striking.
Because it's already a criminal offense regardless.
Right.
Now, I think the plus, the reasoning behind that is because of the emotional issues involved with, being a member of a marginalized group. And so if somebody strikes you specifically for that reason, does it carry more emotional harm?
As a policeman, I investigated a lot of these assaults, et cetera, and you show me a person that doesn't get the crap beat out of them, it's not emotional. It really, the motive to me is, although the person is disturbed and wants to beat a person for the color of their skin, we should try him for what he did, not mental crimes or thought crimes. I don't think thought crimes should be tried.
So where's the line then if you have, you know, attempted murder but you didn't actually succeed?
What do you mean the line?
Well, you have attempted murder, so you attempted to poison the soup that the person actually ended up not eating, but you somehow get into court and prove that they did. I mean, there's intent there, and there would have been serious consequences had I ate the soup.
It's mens rea is what they use in court. It's a guilty mind, so that is a bit of a thought crime, but. I don't know. I've never really thought a lot about it, but if you, he did commit an action. So there was more than just a thought going on there. He did put poison in the soup, in your case. So I have no problem with attempted murder.
Okay.
Tried.
And never eating soup around Sean again.
I think we're so offended generally as a society by racism. And I think we are. I mean, I make this comment and people, often disagree with me, but I don't think there's any authentic racism left in society. And I know people think I'm insane when I say that.
You say that 5 minutes towards the end of the show?
I say it all the time.
That's when I'm going to get my comment.
It's such an absurd idea, racism, and that. So there's lots of people who don't like affirmative action, or there's lots of people who don't like immigration. There's lots of people who don't like all sorts of things. But genuine racism, I don't see any evidence of it. Now, I'm not a minority. You can't see that on radio, but I'm a white male, so maybe that puts me in a. Maybe I don't understand what people face as minorities, but racial prejudice is such a ignorant view to hold that I just can't believe it's prevalent.
Well, and this is a whole different show, so many of my conversations are whole different shows, because I disagree with you, absolutely. But
they always happen 3 minutes before the show
always
ends.
We planned it that way.
Yeah, we're not even going to go into that. There's a difference between people being douchey racists in public and institutionalized racism. But maybe we'll have you back for another show. So, what else did I have? Since you were at Eberwash, and we can't talk about it too much, but where does free speech come in protests? Because the indigenous group there occupied the space.
Right, the Stony Point.
Yes. Yeah. So where does it, and I understand there were a whole bunch of different factors involved in that, but do we have the right to tear gas people for being involved in, for not being willing to unoccupy?
Well, Eberwash is, that's an hour short.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But those people, they signed a modern contract during the war that we would borrow their land by force. They didn't have a choice. We said, we're borrowing your land and we're going to give it back to you after the war, and we never did. And they wanted their land back. It's not really an issue of speech. And then we acted as gangsters, and we went on, and ultimately I say we because I didn't shoot him, but they murdered Dudley George, the police did, and I believe it was premeditated, And I met Dudley George probably 24 times. He was quite a colorful character. I started to like him after a while, but I knew his time was up. And, you know, one time he pulled down his pants and showed his butt to me and said, "You want to spank me?" And I said, "Dudley, when the state decides to spank you, you won't be laughing." And they eventually spanked him to death. Figurative way.
I want to have another hour to this show. Okay, but we don't.
Seal the studio here, take over the station, but it might affect our long-term survival on air.
Okay, you know.
See, this is an example of self-censorship.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We choose to continue on in the long-term versus the mission now.
You know, that's all the time we have today, people.
That's
thank you so much, Dennis and Matthew, for coming. That was
a very interesting conversation.
We'll come back anytime.
Wonderful.
Sounds great.
Audience, if you want these guys back, why don't you send us an email or write some comments on the blog at www.skepticallyspeaking.com. And thank you so much to everybody. Thanks to Brownian. Thanks to Mike Harrison for being on the air. And we will see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
All right, we'll see you then. And I did promise shout-outs, so I'm going to quickly do that here. We do have Michael, who also started following us during the show today, and that was sufficient amount of time for me to find my extra music. Perfect. Thank you, Michael, so much for that.
Could I tell my friend Steve to meet us for beers after?
Go ahead. We've got the music just queuing up.
Anybody? We're going to be at the Elephant and Castle at around 8 o'clock, the one downtown in City Center. Come drink with the libertarians and the knot.
And the knot. Have a good night, everyone.
Does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall off, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie. Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our body.